Tom Woods Show, episode 6,5332.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Tom Woods Show. Of course, I am not Tom Woods. I am Dave Smith, filling in for Tom Woods, who I am quite thrilled to say is doing a lot better, and I think he'll be back here with you good people soon. But while Tom is still getting his health intact, he asked me to be one of his guest hosts, which I was honored to do, and he asked me who I would like to interview for the show, and the first person I said was, of course, Jeff Deist, who is the president of the Mises Institute and was once the chief of staff for the great Ron Paul. And he very kindly agreed last minute to come do this. So Jeff, welcome back to the Tom Woods Show. Thank you for agreeing.
Hey, Dave, thank you. And I will say I spoke to Tom on the phone today and he sounded like his normal self.
That's great. That's really great. I know I was pretty scared there for a little bit, as I know a lot of the people who listen to the show were, and I'm sure you were as well. So it's really just wonderful to see Tom recovering.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a lot going on, and there's obviously a lot of stuff that I've been involved in the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus. And I was curious to talk to you about what your thoughts were on some of this stuff. On the podcasting, on the whole kind of project that we're embarking in. I know that everybody in the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus really has a whole lot of respect for your opinion. And of course, you know, the caucus is named after Ludwig von Mises, but I think really after the Mises Institute as well. And so I thought maybe we would talk about that. Is there any place you'd like to start?
Well, I would say I follow you. I keep track of your stuff, I guess, from a distance, not super close, but I have been known to both you and Michael Heiss and to Tom Woods, for that matter, to be a little bit on the outside, throwing rocks in from time to time, I guess. I understand the impulse. I mean, you've got this party. It has the name Libertarian in it. It has ballot access, or presumably has ballot access. And it's got an immediacy to it that longer-term projects don't have, because you have a campaign or you have fundraising or you have something right in front of you every 2 years or 4 years or maybe even more frequently locally. And I am very much aware of and respectful of the criticism of places like the Mises Institute that, hey, guys, come on. Education's great. 900-page books are great, but it's a little late. You know, it's the eighth inning. It's the bottom of the eighth, and we got to be in there because things are getting weird and wild and reckless in this country, and all that academic stuff and all that theoretical stuff is all well and good, but it's not what's required today. And I understand that criticism. I think you need both, I suppose. But the thing that I don't like is I think that the party itself is almost like almost every institution in the West is actually well to the left of its own fans and supporters and donors and readers and consumers. I mean, you could say that about almost every libertarian organization. You could say that about the Republican Party. You could say that about the Democratic Party. You could say that about just about every mainline Protestant denomination, virtually every synagogue, virtually every Catholic diocese, virtually every civic social institution from Kiwanis on down. I mean, this is the problem, is that there's been a cultural capture by the left. And I guess part of my unease with the project and part of my critique of you and Michael Heiss is that I'm not sure that everyone's fully cognizant of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I am. I mean, I completely agree with you. And it's a really interesting kind of nationwide, I was going to say, but really, I think it's bigger than just in America. But it is a phenomenon that to the left, and particularly to the woke left, like not to the so much the kind of like true democratic socialist left, it's a very kind of corporate woke propaganda left of the customer base. And that's true almost always. I mean, I do think the Mises Institute is probably the only exception to that in the libertarian world. But I think the way I look at it, my critique wouldn't be of the Mises Institute, well, you guys are just kind of focused on spreading ideas and we have to get out there in the real world and actually, you know, affect some type of political change. I look at what we're doing as very similar to the Ron Paul project, not as being a congressman, but in terms of running for president, which is to say that this is a great opportunity to introduce more people to the ideas and kind of funnel more people into the Mises Institute. And I think that there is an argument, as you said, that, well, hey, we're in the eighth inning here and we don't have time for this stuff anymore. But I think, you know, I mean, we did have two world wars in the 20th century. It's hard for me to soberly, objectively say, no, this is really so bad right now that we can't work on this kind of intellectual project anymore. I think it's really our only hope is to spread these ideas, which is, I think, what the Mises Institute is all about. And that's certainly what I've been all about.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the ideas are still there, but they really need people. That's what we know about Ron is... without people, these ideas aren't animated. And so that's why personally I'm at least as interested in, let's say, Mises the man, his story, how that shaped him, what that, you know, his personal life, his character, his intransigence, his courage. I mean, to me, that's an essential part of the story. And libertarians have a, you know, they have a nasty tendency to become these sort of heads without bodies, these sort of deracinated people who are caught up. And, you know, I'm very much over the idea that Americans are natural libertarians. They aren't. And that's okay. Look, for example, what the LGBT people did with 1-3% of the population in just a span of 20 odd years. They basically got everything they wanted. And they did so because they were very savvy politically. They used the legislatures when they had to. They used the courts when they had to. They used executive orders when they had to. They used corporate pressure, social opprobrium, the media. They had a lot of people who were not necessarily LGBT themselves or even in LGBT movements who were nonetheless sympathetic to their cause. You know, people in media and art, performing arts and, you know, corporate honchos and that sort of thing. So that's a tremendous success story for a tiny, relatively tiny minority of the population. So, you know, I don't believe this idea that you got to have 51% of the population with you. Let's say, Dave, that 10% of America is reasonably coherent in their views on politics and economics. That's 30 million people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's bigger than all but a few of the biggest European countries. 30 million people is plenty, plenty, plenty. But I do think even today in the digital age, there needs to be some degree of geographic concentration. I'm not sure that there's a way around that. I understand the Free State Project and things like that. But I think that 30 million people is a lot. But when they're attenuated, spread all over the country, you know, then their impact is not felt as strongly. So that's, I'm more interested in separation than persuasion. If there's anything the last 4 or 5 years have taught us, it's that you only have so much time and energy. You have to have guerrilla tactics. In other words, you have to try to get the most bang for your buck in whatever you do. And I think this idea that you are going to win over 80 million people, let's say, to vote for even a Rand Paul or something, I think is increasingly dubious.
Yeah, so I completely agree with that. And I think that, I mean, look, I think sometimes it's a little bit of a false choice, you know, between like, do we win over 2 million people or 80 million people? I mean, look, if it could be done, then sure. But being realistic, I agree with you. I think it's more likely that we could, you know, I don't know. It's hard to argue that Americans are natural libertarians at this point. But I do think there's got to be more people, much like myself, who can be introduced to these ideas and persuaded by them. So I think it's a good idea to try to get as many people as we can. And I think perhaps you're right that ultimately the best thing after we've created more people is to concentrate them in some area. So I don't, you know, I certainly don't disagree with that. I just think that, you know, how we go about introducing these ideas to as many people as possible is very important because I think currently we really don't have big enough numbers to do something like that, even with what they're doing in New Hampshire. You know, when you talk about the LGBT community, which is a really good example of a very small group of people who had a radical influence on government policies and society and culture in general, do you think we're up against something there where it's like, I remember reading Rothbard talk about how the kind of a Fabian incrementalist approach works well for... What got you already?
Yeah, I hear you.
Well, right, because he was saying this works well for the people who are advocating more centralized power because you're going with the wind. But people who are advocating decentralized power or limiting of power, this goes against all of the incentives. So it's much less likely to be successful. It's much easier for an AOC to say, hey, big, huge, powerful government, let's take a little bit more power. You know, whereas if someone, even like a Paul Ryan type figure says, hey, maybe we should try to balance the budget in 75 years or something like that. You know, they're running ads where he's pushing grandma off a cliff.
Yeah, the incrementalism thing is, I think, very powerful and very true. So the question has always been for people who see the world like us, does it require some sort of economic catastrophe, some sort of cataclysm, some sort of war, some sort of terrible market crash, you know, some sort of nasty shock wherein people lose some of their day-to-day material comfort to bring about any of the kind of changes we'd like to see? Or, you know, is this something we could do gradually just by appealing to people's reason and emotion and self-interest? You know, it seems to me that Trump and COVID are almost those kind of events. I mean, right. they're pretty big events. This is, libertarians are really dopey about Trump. They never got it. They never understood that that many millions of people went off the reservation and voted for the TV show guy. I mean, they never understood that opportunity. And so that was a huge, huge thing. And then, of course, what we find in 2020 is they'll literally shut down the world to get Trump, okay? Over a virus. And it worked in part. Maybe Trump would have been gotten anyway, but just to make sure, they shut down 7 billion people in part to get Trump, and they got him. So that seems to me also like an unbelievable turning point. The thing about revolutions is that you're not aware of them until they've happened. You know, that's what Garrett's essay, The Revolution was all about. It's happening around you, but you don't have the benefit of hindsight yet. So what happened in 2020 represents the greatest shot we've had at some degree of subsidiarity, federalism, localism, or even outright secession that we'll probably ever see in multiple lifetimes. I mean, not only were the CDC and the UN and the WHO unable to project any authority internationally, all these countries just immediately closed their borders and said, we're going to do what we're going to do. Singapore went at this thing very different than China, very different than Japan, very different than Sweden. So all of a sudden, there was no international agency with any legitimacy. But then here at home, we saw the same thing. I mean, we had a beautiful, beautiful experiment between the 50 states. And it's like nothing I've ever seen, where all of a sudden, people were thinking of themselves as Californians and Floridians and New Yorkers and New Jerseyites far more than they had ever thought of themselves as that before. And we had different governors lashing out at each other. You had Gavin Newsom alluding to the Republic of California. That's what DeSantis ought to be doing now, by the way. Yeah. You have this incredible United Van Lines survey of, you know, who's moving out of what state, who's moving into what state. And as you might imagine, the big losers were California and New York and New Jersey and Illinois. And the big gainers were Florida and Texas and Tennessee and, you know. So that is before our eyes unfolding, not even that slowly, a form of soft secession. I mean, there's nothing else to call that. So this to me is really, really exciting and far more exciting than, you know, Nikki Haley versus Kamala Harris 2024.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so I think it's such an interesting point. A lot of really interesting stuff there. I remember thinking, I was talking about this on my podcast, Part of the Problem, that it really reminded me almost of something out of the Soviet Union like before they built the wall, and people are flooding into West Germany from East Germany. And yet Pravda is telling you that this is the paradise for workers here. But then, you know, you can see with your own eyes where people are going. So the entire corporate press is telling you that, you know, New York and New Jersey and California handled this thing so well. And Florida was, and South Dakota, these places were just terrible. And Texas, this is so risky that they would open up like this. And yet you just see it. I mean, you see like everyone in these places knows people. Everyone who I know who lives in New York knows close friends who moved to Florida or moved to Texas. So it's such a contradiction between, it's a real, like, you know, the emperor's new clothes type of situation where they're just telling you something that you can see with your own eyes is clearly, transparently not the reality. And yeah, I really do agree with you on the whole Trump thing. Not that you have to be a Trump supporter or that you have to apologize for the things he was really bad on, you know? But it was just such a monumental event that the Republican base would turn against the Bushes and give the biggest middle finger they could find to the corporate press and to the establishment of both parties. And yeah, I agree with you. I think libertarians were really goofy on that issue to just jump on and repeat the corporate press talking points of, oh, he's this horrible bigot or something like that, and to not get what was going on in the country. And I agree with you that this does, it feels like this is the biggest opportunity. It's one of the reasons why I was so frustrated with the 2020, you know, LP campaign, because this was such an opportunity. And this is unlike anything in my lifetime.
Trump won as a third-party candidate.
Yeah.
I mean, he had the R next to his name and the ballot access. But beyond that, he didn't have a single local precinct. He didn't have any ground game. He had the outright opposition of the leadership of his own party. And he won as a third party. And, you know, this is like, it's as though Ross Perot had won. People need to take stock of that. And he put an end to the Clintons, too.
Yeah.
Which is really something. I mean, that is something. And so the way to follow that up is to put the pedal to the metal, not to, sort of take stock of things and catch your breath and, you know, start saying milquetoast things like, we're socially liberal, fiscally conservative, right. Which, by the way, are totally incompatible to anybody yes. listening. It's like choose one, because socially liberal doesn't lead to fiscally conservative. It leads to a bunch of dysfunction and out of wedlock kids and, crappy society.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And also, what does socially liberal even mean anymore is like a pretty big question. And at least if you're talking about the left wing cultural stuff that's being crammed down everyone's throats from all, you know, areas of what Curtis Yarvin would call the cathedral, you know, the corporate press and academia and the political class and all of the big corporations. People hate that stuff. Why would you even want to associate yourself with that? I mean, it's wildly unpopular. I also think that, to me, one of the really big parts of the moment that we're living in, which, you know, we were kind of touching on with, you know, the different states competing and how much better the states who didn't lock down and didn't have these crazy restrictions, how much better they did, is that it feels to me like the whole narrative of the COVID regime is really collapsing. And the only thing that I could compare this to in my life is the war in Iraq. And I remember early on in the COVID hysteria making a lot of comparisons to the war in Iraq, because there were certain parallels that just stuck out to me. The constant changing of the, you know, the moving of the goalposts about the reasoning for everything, you know, going from flattening the curve to until there's a vaccine, to until there's no new cases, and just constantly, it really reminded me of, you know, we have to go in because of weapons of mass destruction. And then before you know it, they're like, well, we were here to spread democracy. That was always the purpose of this. And you're like, wait, I do remember what you told me when we went in here. And it also, I see a parallel in just how the narrative is completely collapsed. And now, you know, looking back at it, I think a huge portion of the American people see that Fauci was wrong about so much, see that the heroes of the COVID lockdown, like Cuomo or something like that, is completely disgraced at this point. And it reminds me of the disgraced neocons. But this is so much bigger. I mean, don't get me wrong, the war in Iraq was really terrible, but to be brutally honest about it, it was terrible really for those people over there and for the very small percentage of our population, you know, the young men who we bribe and propagandize into going and fighting these wars. But this was terrible for the overwhelming majority of our population. I mean, we literally overturned every social norm in our culture down to seeing people's faces. And that being exposed as all based off lies and pseudoscience, I mean, I agree with you. You never know the revolution until it's over, but man, that feels really big.
Yeah, I've heard other people say this is bigger than Iraq, and that's an interesting point. The similarity is that at the outset, when this was first unfolding, there's the fog of war. We had the fog of war right after 9/11. You know, there's all these theories and ideas and facts flying around, and then half of them turn out to be completely wrong. The problem is that some of the ultimate facts aren't reported or uncovered for maybe a decade, and then the outrage is gone. You know, I remember there was Saddam Hussein has yellow cake uranium or something like that. And I was thinking, is that the little round thing in the urinal? Like, I didn't know. Like, all of a sudden, you know, everyone was an expert on yellow cake, just like when Trump got into office, everyone all of a sudden learned about the emoluments clause and was mouthing off, you know? Right. So it really is the fog of war. And government loves that. It loves those first few months because everybody's scared. It's like, what is this thing? Is this some really lethal virus? And is this some really transmissible virus? Well, those are two pretty important questions to most people. And so I think the average person said, well, you know, better safe than sorry. And wow, did they ever take advantage of that? I mean, they moved on in. And Trump was just helplessly flailing around like a big overgrown child or something. So that was disappointing. He had an opportunity there to maybe win the election if he had stood firm and said, you know what? We're not shutting down our country. We're going to allow real federalism. We're going to allow different governors to do different things. We're going to allow different areas. You know, companies with older employees should send them home. Companies with younger employees should have them out there working, doing everything so that they could obtain that all-important herd immunity that we still are, I think, are on the cusp of if we just get the hell out of the way. So yeah, it was really something. My greatest fear is for small children and infants. I mean, having those masks on their parents or whatever. And when I see these poor little kids in airports forced to wear the mask, I mean, I can barely stand the thing for a few hours on a plane and imagine their tiny little respiratory systems and just their psychology.
Yeah.
You know, oh man, that's really something. And other than the Iraq War, or maybe equal to, I don't know where it stands, but it's certainly the biggest assault on personal liberty in our lifetimes. And so I don't think there's any other way to see it. So narrative, schmerative. I mean, you know, I know what Walter Block would say. He'd say, Jeff, principles don't scale. Doesn't matter if 10 people die or if 10 million people die. It's the same principle. And I think that's true at the end of the day.
Yes. On a moral level, I understand what he's saying. But practically speaking, in terms of like the impact that it has on a society is, I think, different. And so that's kind of more of what I'm thinking about, like how big, you know, it's one thing when someone else's kid got lied into war far away, but when you actually had your own life ruined over this, people are much more likely, I think, to see through the propaganda. I saw just the other day, I'm blanking on his name, but it was like a big comedian guy who was completely, you know, just in line with all of the approved opinions. And he's furious because Fauci just said that people who are vaccinated can transmit the Delta variant just as easily as the non-vaccinated. And you see this guy who's like been a good little soldier, followed all of the directions, and now is being told that did nothing. It turns out that did absolutely nothing.
I think that was Michael Rappaport.
Yes, Michael Rappaport, yes.
He's been in some Woody Allen stuff. I think he's been in some Spike Lee stuff.
Yes, correct. Yeah. So that's interesting to me, right? Like I look at that and I go, oh, that's really interesting if even people who have bought into this are starting to see some of the cracks in it. And then, of course, the people who have been seeing the cracks for a while, this is just like conclusive proof to them. I absolutely think you're right about Donald Trump and his great failure. I mean, of course, his great failure, which ironically was always really his inability to wield power It was not the leftist critique of him that he was a strong man. He was weak. I mean, the guy, you know, they'd say he's a wannabe dictator or something like that. I mean, he was framed by his own, you know, deep state for treason, and he couldn't even get those guys fired, let alone put in jail. I mean, you know, if he wanted to be a strongman dictator, he wasn't a very good one. I think strongman dictators would have had a very clear solution for all of those guys who betrayed him. But really the problem with Trump was he was just never up to the occasion of what he could have represented. You know, as Scott Horton says, and I think he's right about that. He goes, you know, we needed Ron Paul, but we got Donald Trump. And that's pretty much the story of America. But Donald Trump, I mean, he didn't have the strength to really take on the national security state. And when the COVID regime kind of rose up, he just, like you said, he just flailed. He had no idea what to do. He really had no strategy. It's the same thing with the election. He just whined about the potential for fraud in voting by mail for 4 months. And then he lost. And then he whined about it for another 2 months. And then he left. It turns out that was the strategy.
Yeah, there's a margin of fraud in every election, presumably.
Yeah.
Did Biden really get 8 million more votes? I don't know. Biden probably won the popular vote, but whether Biden won the Electoral College, you'd have to have knowledge on the ground in those places like Arizona and Georgia. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. Trump would have been better off announcing from the outset that he was only going to serve one term and just gone scorched earth. I mean, he would have been terrible in his second term. We could have left Bagram Air Force Base in January of 2017 when he entered office.
Yep.
It took Joe Biden to leave Bagram Air Force Base. We left a lot of expensive staplers and such, Humvees laying around over there. So what a mess. But yeah, I mean, Trump ain't the problem. Trump's a symptom of a deeper problem. And it irritates me that libertarians went hook, line, and sinker with this phony narrative. The alt-right was a media creation. Even back in 20, if you were talking about the alt-right in 2016, you were a dupe of Hillary and company. There was the alt-right was a few thousand outsized loud voices on social media. No institutions, no nothing. That's all it ever was. If you're talking about the alt-right in 2021, you were flat out gaslighting. I mean, there's nothing else to say. The alt-right didn't elect Trump. You know who elected Trump? In those swing states, I believe it was 6 states that he swung from Obama. It was disaffected boomers who were economically feeling insecure, many of whom had voted for Obama once, if not twice.
Yeah.
And, you know, literally 120,000 votes the other way scattered across those 6 swing states would have meant that Hillary Clinton had won. So this idea that the alt-right collected Trump, total nonsense. And to hear these libertarian types still going after you or Michael Heiss or poor Pete Quinones, or, you know, I mean, the alt-right, you might as well be talking about the Whigs.
Yeah. Look, the only thing I would push back on you about there, I mean, you're completely right in everything you say, but when you talk about libertarians, just try to keep in mind the proportions that we're talking about here, because the people who go after me about being alt-right or whatever, these people have like 0 followings and everything they post gets ratioed by, like, they get 3 likes and 100 people mocking them. And all the people you just named are the ones who are influential and have followings and stuff like that. So I agree with you. Those people are purely gaslighting. And if not, that's actually the worst option, that they're that stupid. But I do think that the dominant part of the libertarian movement, or whatever you want to call us, the libertarians, really see through that stuff. And it's really kind of comical at this point, where you have this, you know, like, there was this real concern about a rise of fascism from, you know, the couple hundred people who marched in 2017, none of whom had as big a following as, like, I have right now. I mean, these were, nationally speaking, very insignificant figures. And this was, oh my God, there's the rise of fascism. And meanwhile, like, today, you know, you have Australia, you know, locking down the entire country over one COVID death. You have France just announced that they'll be imposing year-long prison sentences for businesses who serve people without the vaccine passport. You have Joe Biden's government announcing that they are turning the war on terrorism inward to fight against domestic terrorists, which are really just political dissidents. The idea that you think the threat of fascism was coming from those 200 people, I mean, it's so beyond absurd.
Yeah, if you want to talk about fascism, let's talk about the Patriot Act. Let's talk about right. Medicare Part D. I mean, there we have fascism. It's
yeah.
just, you know, but the idea that Trump was somehow more fascist than Obama or Bush or something is absurd.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I wanted to touch on what you were saying before, because I do think it's like one of the most important things for people to understand about why Donald Trump got elected. Did you ever see there was a debate between David Frum, the awful neocon, and Steve Bannon? And they debated at the Monk, I think it's called the Monk Society or something like that, the Monk debates.
In London, maybe.
Was it in London? I can't remember where they had them, but they—
So
they
it wasn't the Oxford debates.
You know, no, it wasn't the Oxford debates.
No, I didn't see it, but I can imagine it.
It was, I gotta say, it was fantastic. And I really highly recommend anyone who hasn't watched it, watch it. And I know, look, Steve Bannon, I'm sure there's a bunch of issues that, you know, we wouldn't agree with him on. He's certainly way too much of a China hawk and an Iran hawk and, you know, but he really made such a compelling argument. And he won the debate in a very hostile crowd that was very hostile toward him. And he basically made the point, which he was so spot on about, was that he was like, look, this has nothing to do with the alt-right or races. Here's why Donald Trump got elected. And he goes back to the financial crisis in 2008 and how this whole thing almost, you know, brought the economy to its knees and something like whatever the numbers are. He had like 40% of the wealth in America was transferred from the working class and the middle class to the very upper class. And that the recovery efforts were basically to jack up government spending to record highs and lower interest rates to record lows. And so on paper, they show this recovery, but who's really getting the money? It's like, well, the people playing in the Wall Street casino, the speculators are now raking in profits because of these low interest rates. The politically connected are getting money through the government spending. But that's the whole thing, that regular working class people who did vote for Obama because they hated the Bush administration after all that stuff too, they saw no recovery. And the whole time while this is happening, you know, the corporate press is focusing on like transgender bathrooms or something like that. And so they were just furious with the whole thing, the economy, the culture, and all of it. And they wanted the guy who said he would stand up for them and be a big middle finger to the establishment who betrayed them. It's so obvious.
Well, I hope if you decide to run for president, God forbid, that you will understand that populism, A, is a tactic. It's not an ideology unto itself. It's an empty vessel. You imbue it with your own views. And two, that populism is entirely justified when elites screwed everything up. This idea that populism represents this dark and dangerous force, no, it's a reaction. That's what it means to be a reactionary. Progressives always forget this, like, oh, you reactionaries. Well, to what are we reacting exactly?
Right.
Guess what? Look at the 20th century. What did they screw up? Money, banking, war and peace, diplomacy, public education, medicine, media. I mean, elites screwed the pooch. Ever since Wilson, ever since World War I, they've done nothing but screw us. So, you know, this idea, oh, you populists represent this dark and malevolent force. No, I'm sorry. When elites have failed this badly, populism is entirely justified. And I think you have, you know, let's just say, you know, you're a comedian. I think you have a reasonably blue-collar vibe to you as opposed to a wonkish vibe. And, you know, if you're going to be involved in movement libertarianism or running as a candidate or something, I think you should go with it.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I've always said that I think libertarians are in many ways the true populists and the best populists, because we actually have what most populists are missing, which is like a firm understanding of exactly how the elites are screwing over regular people. And I don't understand how you could be a libertarian and understand how this whole racket works, whether we're talking about cronyism, the revolving door, from politics to big business, regulatory capture, the Federal Reserve, war profiteering, and not look at that. And I'd almost say inherently what we are populists. We see under this status system, the elites ripping off the American people. And so to me, that's obvious.
Yeah, we need some revisionism. Just, you know, if you read Rothbard, if you read Conceived in Liberty, if you read Patrick Newman, who's now writing books on cronyism in American history, the idea that these are all just sort of, aw shucks, pretty much well-intentioned people is like, well, okay, you know, this America as an idea. No, America was a place with people, and those people had interests. I'm all for revisionism, which is exactly why I don't get as exercised as maybe you might think about CRT, for example. What I object to with revisionism is it's only taught one way. You know, it's always the direction of Howard Zinn. It's never the direction of Murray Rothbard. But imagine if some, let's say some virtually all black school district in Cook County, Chicago, Illinois, wants to teach what I would consider maybe even a false version of American history, that America is deeply and uniquely racist, founded on genocide. CRT is our basic curriculum. The 1619 Project is our touchstone. You know, I might not love that, but I also don't think that anyone other than taxpayers of Cook County, Illinois, ought to have any say over what that school district does. So that's the price. That's the price you pay for true federalism, true subsidiarity, true localism, is that you have to accept, and this is where libertarians, I think, fall apart, is when it comes to this universalist creed, which I think is a huge mistake. There's several points just in Human Action, but also in definitely in liberalism, maybe in nation, state, and economy, where Mises basically blasts universalism and says, by what authority, by what God do we make these pronouncements? So I think you have to be willing to pay the price. And the price is that other people don't see the world the way you do, and that other people aren't very libertarian, and that libertarianism is not something that can be imposed. It can't be imposed. A lot of people just have no interest in it whatsoever. They think it's absolutely crazy. So again, I'm looking for people who are talking about separation rather than persuasion.
Huh. Yeah, I think Mises agreed with you on that, and certainly Hoppe would have agreed. Do you think, did Rothbard get that wrong?
Well, look, I think you could say there are universal human rights. We don't even need Rothbard. We can just take Walter Black's interpretation of Rothbard and say all of this is, of course, universal, Jeff, because everybody owns their body. Everyone ought to have the right to not be physically infringed upon with their body, held captive or physically aggressed against. And from that, we can spiral out in little concentric circles and say, well, you need property because you can't just be standing naked on an unowned spit of ground. You're going to need some property. You're going to need some clothes. You're going to need some calories to come into your body. You're going to need some sort of habitation, presumably. And so these things flow from ownership of your person. I mean, I would certainly grant that to any human on earth. And if someone says, Jeff, is that universal? I would say in Jeff world, and certainly in Walter world, that's universal. But like the libertarian conception of property rights, go talk about that to a Zen Buddhist and he'll look at you like you're 10 feet tall or something. I mean, so many things we think are universal aren't. And that's what the populist pushback of the 21st century is all about, whether that's Brexit, whether that's Trump, whether that's Orban in Hungary, whether that's Catalonia, whether that's Scottish independence, whether that's Taiwan and China. I just think universalism is a bridge too far. And I think we gotta jettison it.
Right. So even, by the way, I should kind of amend what I said, because even from like a Hoppean perspective, I mean, there is certainly something universal about argumentation ethics. But I think he would say on a practical level, like you were saying, that we should be realists and understand that these ideas are going to have, they're going to be received differently in different parts of the world. And if we don't accept that, then we're not dealing with reality.
Right, but even in the West, there are plenty of Christians who will say, no, self-ownership, God owns us.
Right.
You know, so these things that are self-evident, I think there's axiomatic deductive knowledge in economics, certainly. I'm not sure that that applies to political science.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to look at it. It's interesting to me because I just, you know, I'm like in this kind of strange position where I am really, you know, I'm a Mises Institute Ron Paulian type of guy. Like, this is how I came into this movement or this world, whatever we are. And those were always like the thinkers who really, you know, introduced me to these ideas and converted me, you know, Ron Paul and Murray Rothbard and Mises and Tom Woods and everyone in this camp. And I just find these conversations so interesting, like just the conversation we're having right now. But I'm also in a position where I go around to other groups in the libertarian world. And, you know, I'll do Kennedy's show regularly. And I just did an interview with Reason for the Reason interview series. I just did one that was released earlier today. Nick Gillespie interviewed me. And it's just so interesting that while they use this same term, libertarian, I think While I have this conversation, and I think this is just such a fascinating conversation, I think they would look at us like we were 10 feet tall for even talking like this. And it's, I don't know, I'm kind of curious, like, your thoughts of that. Like, how wide is the gap between Cato and Mises or Reason and Mises?
Well, it's pretty wide. They have appended a set of left cultural precepts to thin libertarianism. And you could equally and validly criticize me for appending, I guess, right cultural, I don't know about precepts, but preferences. But here's the thing. You know, I don't share progressive ends. If you say, well, look, we agree with you progressives, it's just we want to get there using libertarian means. No, not even close. And then also, both Reason and Cato have been dreadful over the years towards Rothbard, towards New Rockwell, towards Ron Paul, towards the Mises Institute. So there's that. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not one of these people who says, well, it doesn't matter, it's all just ideas. No, these are people I, except for Rothbard, know and love personally. So I don't care about your ideology or your ideas. If you attack someone I love, screw you.
Yeah, and try to ruin them, not attack like their ideas. They're attacking them personally.
So, you know, I don't really know what Cato is. Public policy is dead in the water. Maxine Waters is chairman of the Financial Services Committee. Go give her your NGDP targeting white paper, please, because she's a big brainiac when it comes to, you know, she's basically in running for Fed chair. So public policy is an absolute farce. There's no such thing. As for Reason, you know, they went through their sort of transhumanist techno period. I'm not that familiar. They were very, very slimy to signal boost the Jamie Kirchick stuff about the Ron Paul newsletters because Brian Ripley, is that his last name? Gosh, no, I'm sorry. What's Brian's last name at Reason Magazine?
Daugherty.
Brian Daugherty, I apologize because I do know him and I like him. I apologize for forgetting his name there. But Brian Daugherty followed Ron Paul, like, I think it was in the 2012 campaign. It may have been 2008. He wrote a whole book about it.
Right.
So they literally, they know Ron. I mean, they know he doesn't have a racist bone in his body. So to signal boost that and then try to say like, well, we just have a journalistic responsibility. No. You're libertarian advocacy. You're not a newspaper reporting facts or something. Yeah, they could have just dismissed that and said, well, we know Ron Paul. He's not our cup of tea because he's kind of this Christianish doctor guy, but he's not a racist. You know, that should have been the approach. But look, that's just the way it is. I mean, these divisions are part and parcel of human nature. It's not infighting. It's part of human nature. And in any endeavor, any activity, with any degree of entrepreneurial energy, you have to accept the interpersonal stuff as part of it and work within it. And a guy like you, I mean, people like you. You're good at straddling these different camps. I don't have to, fortunately, but because, you know, a lot of these people at Cato and Reason really dislike the Mises Institute. I mean, it's quite mutual, shall we say. But, you know, that's fine. People can say, well, Ford and Chevy, you both make cars. Why don't you guys get along? Okay.
Right. You know, there was an interesting moment that I had. Well, there were a few interesting moments that I had while Nick Gillespie was interviewing me. And like we, you know, it was fine. Like we got along fine during it. But, you know, he tried to grill me a little bit on some things, which I think is not inappropriate, you know, like in that setting to kind of, you know, kick the tires a little bit and see what's going on here and where I'm at. But I think that you really are, you're absolutely right when you say that they've kind of bought into a very progressive or left-wing worldview that I'm not even sure they're aware of at times. You know, he said to me at one point something like, he was like, well, you're definitely like a right, you know, libertarian or a right-wing libertarian or something like that. And I don't know. I'm not offended by that. It's okay if you want to call me that. I don't really know. And then he brought up a quote. This must have been an old quote from like a couple of years ago on my podcast where I had basically, I was talking about how awful I thought it was that we lived in a society where so many kids were just like dropped in daycare, raised by nannies, raised by the public school system, and not raised by their parents. And he goes, well, is that really the libertarian position, you know, to be judging people for different lifestyles and all of this? And I just thought it was almost kind of amusing in a way to go, so you find this to be like some right-wing position that I think parents should raise their kids? Like this is what makes me like some crazy right-winger?
The difference is that if you call a reason person a left libertarian, they'll say, oh, no, no, no.
Right.
And if you call me a right libertarian, I say, and?
Right. Yeah, like, sure. I mean, I don't know what even it means exactly, but it's like, yeah, I would rather, like, I prefer a society of stable families. And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't advocate using force in order to create that. But I certainly would prefer it. And I think that it's much more likely to be conducive to libertarian outcomes to have a society like that, which I think is a pretty strong
argument. Of course. You can't have no external governance and no internal governance.
Yeah.
So what's right. The source of internal governance? Well, for most people, most normal people, it's their parents and some sort of upbringing and so hopefully instills some sort of moral compunction in that. And then it's religion. I mean, this hostility towards religion, I mean, for most people, that's the governing philosophy. So, you know, while they're busy getting drunk and embezzling from work and cheating on their wife, on some level, they feel bad about it because they went to Sunday school 30 years ago. You're right. I mean, you know, however imperfect, for most people, religion takes, you know, forms a core part of their worldview. And at least it gives them a set of rules or aspirations as opposed to just ad hocism. Right. And so that's just the way of the world. And to ignore that and say, no, we shouldn't have any government or not much of one, but we also shouldn't have any kind of intermediary institutions, any kind of parental authority, any kind of business authority, any kind of hierarchy. It's like, okay, well, choose one.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to choose one. I was going to say unfortunately, but it's actually not unfortunate. It's just that's reality, and it's probably for the better.
Well, you and I are not in the Olympics. We're talking on a podcast. There's a reason why we're not in the Olympics, because there's a hierarchy of athleticism.
Right.
You know, am I going to worry about that? No, I'm going to admire those athletes and enjoy, frankly, the spectacle of that kind of human achievement. I love it. I wish the Olympics weren't so statist, but I really enjoy athletic performance. So hierarchy is, you know, I don't know what to say to this. It's just, again, such a different worldview. So when someone says, well, you should stop this infighting, it's like, well, I don't know if infighting's the word.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with you. And I think that a lot of it is what you said to me years ago about how important it was that the Mises Institute is not in Washington, D.C. And I think that there is just something, there's this really like corrosive force of being close to these power centers where you just start kind of saying the things that won't be unacceptable there. And I noticed that with a lot of other groups that call themselves libertarians. I got to say, I mean, here, I've kept you over time already, but I really, you know, I've always, like I said, my group, whatever you want to call it, my camp in this world has always been the Ron Paul, Tom Woods, Mises Institute, you know, camp. And I was always so proud of all of those guys that when all the big things happened, they were just good on it right away, like always. Whether it was the banker bailouts, the war in Iraq, or the, you know, anything, the whole craziness of the Obama administration, they all just got it right. And it is, you know, I think it is important to note that every one of them were good on COVID right away. Everyone in this camp was just excellent on lockdowns from the beginning, calling out all the hysteria, all the craziness of the COVID regime. And, you know, unfortunately, you really can't say that for much of the rest of the libertarian space. And I think that's worth noting.
Well, fair enough.
All right. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you doing this last minute. Once again, we're just thrilled that that Tom is doing good and he'll be back here talking to you fine people soon enough. And I was honored to be asked to guest host and honored that you would come on with me, Jeff. So thank you very much. Jeff Deist, go check out the Mises Institute. Go to Mises.org. It really is the most incredible website on the planet and has such a wealth of knowledge all throughout. I mean, it's a website that really changed my life. So can't recommend it high enough. And go, I know you guys just did it, but man, Mises University, if you can ever make it out there, is just one of the most fun weeks and one of the most inspiring weeks. And you see these brilliant 20-year-olds who are really interested in like business cycle theory. It makes you feel like maybe the world's going to be okay. All right. Thank you so much, Jeff. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, that was fun.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.